or the massless scalar on De Sitter. We've got this famous scale invariant form with the characteristic 1 over k cubed of scale invariants. In the case of the actual inflationary power spectrum, it's not going to be exactly scale invariants. There's going to be slight deviations from scale invariants. And the traditional way to characterize this is in terms of a quantity called the spectral index. So we define, for any given power spectrum, this quantity ns. It's actually more, for historical reasons, people define ns minus 1 as the quantity which is going to be small. The smaller it is, the more scale invariant you are. And it's defined as this logarithmic derivative of the power spectrum, like so. So this has the property that if your power spectrum is exactly 1 over k cubed, then this just gives you 0. So an ns of 1 is an exactly scale invariant spectrum. If ns is less than 1, this power spectrum is larger for smaller wavelengths than for larger wavelengths compared to a scale invariant spectrum. So in this case, we say it's red tilted. And if ns is greater than 1, we say it's blue tilted. Okay, so in general, this ns isn't necessarily constant. It can be a function of k, depending on what the form of p of k happens to be. If ns does happen to be constant, which you would find, for example, if you computed the power spectrum for a massive scalar field on De Sitter space, you'd find a power spectrum that goes like some power of k, which isn't quite 3, but it's 3 plus some number which depends on the mass of the field. So if ns is constant, p has a form which goes like k to the minus 3 plus ns minus 1. So it has this power law form which differs from 3 by this quantity ns minus 1. And if ns is not constant, you can't just write it as a simple exponential necessarily. We say that this has running of the spectral index. Okay, so the most recent data from the Planck satellite tells us that the spectral index of the scalar modes is not quite scale invariant. It's slightly less than 1. It's 0.96 plus or minus 0.01 or so. So it's been shown that the actual spectral index of the universe, beyond any reasonable uncertainty, is not scale invariant, but it's slightly red tilted. But it's very close to scale invariant. And this is what we'll see in the case of flow rule inflation. The power spectrum comes out to be almost scale invariant, and the deviation from scale invariant is proportional to the slow roll parameter. So if you have slow roll inflation, you'll have an approximately scale invariant spectrum. Okay, so now I want to start going through the computation of the actual fluctuation spectrum from inflation. So you all have gotten a homework set, I believe, which walks you through this calculation. So I'm essentially going to do that. I'm going to go through this calculation, and it's quite a bit. It's quite involved algebraically, but it's one of those things that's worth doing once in your life to see how it's actually done. So the basic idea is that we are going to take, we're going to start with the action for the inflaton field coupled to gravity during the inflationary phase. And we're going to expand it to quadratic order around this inflationary background, because it's the quadratic fluctuations that are responsible for the power spectrum. And we have to deal with all the sort of redundancy that's present in the action. So there's gauge invariance due to the fact that it's general relativity, and there's coordinate invariance. And this gauge invariance is all just redundancy. There's no physics to it. The only reason you have gauge invariance is so that you can write things in ways which manifest the symmetries of the system. In the case of an expanding universe, an FRW universe, there aren't really any, you've broken most of the symmetries anyway, so it's not worth keeping them. So the best strategy is just to kill all the gauge symmetry, which is what we'll do. And we'll be left with an action just for the actual physical gauge invariant fields, which we'll then compute the power spectrum for. Okay, so as a warm-up example, I want to do what we're going to do for inflation, but for a much simpler system, namely Maxwell electromagnetism. Go through the same procedure of getting rid of all the gauge symmetry and killing the Lorentz symmetry and getting it into a form where you have just the physical variables. Okay, so here's just a practice example of the procedure that we're going to do in the inflationary case. So we'll start with electromagnetism. So the Lagrangian is the familiar F mu nu squared of electromagnetism, where F mu nu is the field strength tensor, which is the derivative of the potential. And it's a Lorentz invariant system, as is manifested here, but it's got redundancy, which is the gauge symmetry of electromagnetism. I'm free to change the electromagnetic potential by the derivative of any scalar lambda, and the field configurations that differ by such a change are to be thought of as equivalent. So the only reason to have this gauge symmetry is to have the manifest Lorentz symmetry in the system. If we don't care about the manifest Lorentz symmetry, it's easier just to get rid of the gauge symmetry and to talk completely in terms of gauge invariant variables. So this is what we'll do. We'll just brutalize the Lorentz symmetry. We'll split up A mu into its spatial part and its time part. I being the spatial variables and A0 being the time variables. And we want to decompose this as much as possible so that everything is as invariant as possible under spatial rotations. So we want to keep spatial rotations manifest, but we don't care about the symmetry between space and time. Okay, so this vector field, we can split up into a part which is transverse, which we'll call AI transverse, and a part which is longitudinal, which we'll call phi, like so. So the spatial derivative of AI transverse is going to be zero. So to do this split can be done completely locally in time, even though it's not local in space. So to perform this kind of split, or to show that it's possible, it's convenient to introduce these projection operators, which I'll call Pij. There's a longitudinal projection operator, which is defined as follows. So it involves 1 over Boxberg. It involves the inverse of the spatial Laplacian. So by writing this, we're implicitly assuming that we can solve uniquely the Poisson equation on our spatial slices. So we're essentially assuming that the fields sort of fall off to zero at infinity, so that we have a unique solution for this. And we can write a transverse projector, so. Okay, now what you can show, if you like, is that these projectors form the algebra of projection operators. So P left squared is P left, P right, or not left and right, but longitudinal and transverse. P longitudinal squared is P longitudinal. P transverse squared is again P transverse. And then P longitudinal and P transverse equals zero, and that they sum to one. Okay, so these properties guarantee that given any vector field you like, such as this AI, if you hit it with the longitudinal projector and then hit it with the transverse projector, you will break it up into two pieces, and this breakup is unique, and you've lost no information about the original vector field. The sum of the two things that you've broken up equals the original thing. Okay, so this goes by the name of a Hodge decomposition in mathematics. It's the same thing we did when looking at the polarization of the CMB. We broke up the symmetric tensor into various parts which are longitudinal and transverse. Here we're doing the same thing just with the vector on flat space. And when we do the inflationary case, we'll do the same thing with the symmetric tensor part of the graviton field. Okay, so now the idea is just to take this decomposition and plug it into the action and do it out. So the advantage of using this decomposition is that there will never be any mixing between the scalar parts and the transverse vector parts. Because any sort of term that appears in the action, everything's quadratic in the fields. So if you had such a cross term like this, if there were a cross term between a scalar and a transverse vector, there also has to be another I index to contract. That I index, no matter where it is, if it's here, if it acts on here, it vanishes because of the fact that this is transverse. If it's over here, I can integrate my parts back onto here, and it vanishes. So there can never be any cross terms between the scalar and vector. So by doing this decomposition, we essentially split up the action into its helicity components, into its scalar part and its vector part. So at the end of the day, the Maxwell action becomes a vector part, which looks like this. And a scalar part, which looks like this, a naught minus phi dot, and I'm going to combine it in this way, like so. Okay. So this particular combination of a naught and phi dot is special because it's a gauge invariant combination. So we have to worry about this gauge redundancy here. So we're going to break up the action of the gauge redundancy also into scalar and vector parts. So acting on A naught, the gauge symmetry acts to shift A naught by lambda dot. And then the spatial part, the spatial part acts to shift like this, but then I have to break this into transverse and longitudinal parts, so I have to write this as AI transverse plus d phi equals di lambda. And now on each side of this equation, I can equate the transverse and the longitudinal parts. because they are linearly independent. So from this one equation, if I look at the transverse part, there's no transverse part on this side. It's all just derivative. So I can immediately say that the action of the gauge symmetry on the transverse part is zero. In other words, the transverse part of the spatial photon is gauge invariant. The action on the spatial, on the longitudinal part rather, I can pull off the derivative. It acts to shift by lambda. Okay, so now, looking at this action of the gauge symmetry on A0 and on this transverse part, you can see that this combination, A0 minus phi dot, is in fact gauge invariant. If I do a gauge transformation of this, I get a lambda dot from this, and then I get a minus lambda dot from this, it's 0. So this particular combination is gauge invariant. So the entire action here, in the way it's written here, is manifestly gauge invariant, as it must be, because we started from a gauge invariant action. This part is just gauge invariant because the transverse part is gauge invariant, and then this part is written in terms of this gauge invariant combination. Okay, so now, once we've done the split, it becomes quite simple to just eliminate completely the gauge redundancy. We can make a choice. Because this field phi, this longitudinal part, shifts by lambda, we can choose, so to fix the gauge, we're going to choose lambda such that phi is equal to 0. And it's obvious that I can always do that. No matter what phi is, I just choose lambda to equal that phi and set phi equal to 0. Okay. So once this choice is made, the gauge symmetry is now completely fixed. There's no other gauge symmetry besides lambda, so choosing phi equals to 0 completely eliminates the redundancy. And we're left with an action which just looks like this. And if you like, you can check that it's legal to plug this gauge choice directly into the action and not lose any information. If you look at the equations of motion for phi, both before and after plugging into the action versus taking the equations of motion, you'll find that nothing is lost. So now we have an action which we still have this dependence on this time part of A naught, but you'll notice that there's no time derivatives acting on A naught. So A naught is essentially non-dynamical. So in particular, I can look at the A naught equations of motion, and it simply tells me that gradient of A naught is equal to 0. Or Laplacian of A0 is equal to 0. And under our assumption that the fields all die off at infinity and that there's a unique solution to this equation, this implies that A0, in fact, is equal to 0. So when we plug this, this is the hallmark of an auxiliary field. Its equations of motion can be algebraically solved for A0. And here, when we say algebraically, we don't count spatial derivatives because we're assuming that everything's nicely invertible. So we're only worried about time derivatives acting on A0. And there are no time derivatives here. So A0 is algebraic, which means I can use it within its own, I can solve its own equations of motion, plug back into the action, and get an equivalent action. Yes?
What's that scalar? Sorry, the last term, should that be? Yeah. How is that? Should that be a square of the
okay. There. Okay. Thank you. Okay. So after we plug in this A0 equals 0, we're left with a Lagrangian now that contains only this first part. Okay, so this now is the bare bones Lagrangian of electromagnetism, where all the sort of auxiliary stuff and gauge stuff has been completely stripped away, and we're left with just the physical degrees of freedom. So in terms of number of degrees of freedom here, we know that electromagnetism should have 2 degrees of freedom, the 2 polarizations of the photon. And that's indeed what we have here. We have this transverse vector. So a general vector will have 3 degrees of freedom. A transverse vector has this one constraint that it be transverse, so it carries, in fact, 2 degrees of freedom, which is the right number. Okay, so this is the procedure we're now going to go through for the more complicated version of the full gravitational action coupled to the inflaton field. Any questions? Okay, so this goes under the name of cosmological perturbation theory. Actually, the best reference I know for this is Weinberg's cosmology book, Chapter 5. He does the best job of not cheating and taking into account all the proper gauge symmetry and so on. Okay, so the starting point is the action that's at play during inflation, which is simply general relativity. So here's the Einstein-Hilbert term coupled to our scalar field with some potential V. And the first step for what we want to do is there's going to be some background solution, some FRW background solution. In fact, we're not even going to assume it's an inflationary solution. We're just going to take a general background FRW solution. And then we want to expand this action to quadratic order in fluctuations around that solution. It's that quadratic action that's responsible for the power spectrum. If you wanted to compute the non-Gaussianities or the bispectrum, you'd have to expand to cubic order in the action, or higher order, depending on how high order correlation functions you like. But we're going to do the simplest thing and just talk about the power spectrum, which only requires expanding to quadratic order. Okay, so to start with, let's expand this around a general background solution. So not even necessarily FRW to start with, just to be general for as long as we can. So the idea is we have some, our metric and our scalar are our 2 degrees of freedom here. And we're going to expand them around some background solution and then some perturbation, which we call h mu nu. And then phi will be expanded around some background phi, and then some perturbation, which I'll call squiggly phi. And we want to expand to quadratic order in these variables, squiggly phi and h mu nu. Okay, so the first thing we need is the background equations of motion. So if you vary with respect to the metric here, you get the Einstein equations, the famous gravitational part of the Einstein equation, and then on this side will be the stress tensor of the scalar field, which looks like this. And you'll notice I've scaled the field and the potential so that I've taken M Planck out front so that I don't have M Planck's floating around in the equations of motion. Okay, the scalar equation of motion is the usual Klein-Gordon equation, like so. Okay, now it's just a simple algebraic exercise of taking this action here, plugging this in, and expanding to second order in phi and h mu nu. So these kinds of expansions, if you're not familiar with how to do these, you should learn, because it appears over and over in all sorts of areas of physics. But the kind of formulas you use are things like the inverse metric has to be expanded, so if I call the full inverse metric g mu nu, it has to be expanded. There's formulas like this. And you need all these things up to second order in the various fields. Like the square root of the determinant has to be expanded. And you get formulas like this. So some of these are on that homework sheet it's good to just collect all these formulas and have them somewhere where you can easily see them, because these sorts of expansions reappear over and over again, and you should only have to do these things once, and then you have them, and you can just reuse them over and over. Okay, so at the end of the day, you find that this action, I'll write what the quadratic part of the action looks like after, I'll write what the Lagrangian looks like. So the first order part of the action, the part first order in phi and h mu nu, is going to automatically vanish, because the first order part is just proportional to the equations of motion. Because to get the equations of motion, you just are varying the fields, which is like expanding to first order the fluctuation. So the action starts at this quadratic order if we expand around a proper background. So there is a part which has two powers of the field h mu nu, which looks like this. So this is sort of a universal form of what you get for the kinetic term any time you expand up the Einstein-Hilbert action. There are these four possible contractions. They come with these exact relative coefficients. And this is the structure that's sort of ensured by the gauge symmetry of general relativity, which we'll talk about in a second. So h here means the trace of h. All the covariant derivatives, all the indices you see are all with respect to this background metric. Okay, there's also a part which essentially comes from expanding the potential to second order in H, which looks like this. So here, this is the potential evaluated on the background solution again. And you, in order to get this form, you have to use the background equations of motion. So you're going to get various things from expanding root g, for instance, and from expanding these potentials. And by using the background equations of motion, in particular the trace of the Einstein equation, you'll be able to beat it down into this sort of form. Okay, then there are terms which mix the tensor fluctuation with the scalar fluctuation, like so. So again, big phi is the background field, and little phi is the fluctuation. So these are, again, terms that are quadratic in the fluctuation, but we have one power of the scalar fluctuation and one power of the tensor fluctuation. And then finally, we have terms which contain two powers of the scalar fluctuation. So d of wiggly phi squared, v double prime, wiggly phi squared. So here you recognize a kinetic term and a mass-like term for this scalar fluctuation. Okay, so this is the quadratic action that we're going to work with. But this is in the form which is analogous to the E&M form that we had up there. It's sort of manifestly covariant, but it has all this redundancy still in it, which we want to strip away. Okay, so we have to talk about what this redundancy is. It's gauge, it's diff invariance, it's general coordinate invariance, which is the gauge symmetry of general relativity. So the original action was invariant has this symmetry, delta g mu nu plus d mu c nu plus d mu c nu, delta phi is equal to d mu c nu phi. Okay, so where do these come from? These are just coordinate transformations of the general relativistic action expressed in their infinitesimal form. So for example, if I have a scalar field, phi of x, you're familiar with the fact that if I do a coordinate transformation, all I have to do is change this to phi of x prime, which if I have my coordinate transformation of x going to, let's say, let's call f of x the coordinate transformation, it's going to look like this. So this is how the field phi transforms, and this is a symmetry of the general relativity action, and it's a gauge symmetry because this f of x can be any function. So it represents a redundancy. So now if I express this in infinitesimal form, so let's look at an infinitesimal transformation where x mu, let me put the mu index on here, where x mu goes to x mu plus some small quantity which we call xi mu of x. So xi mu is going to look like a vector field on the manifold. And it's sort of the infinitesimal part of the field transformation. So phi is going to phi plus c, which if I then expand, Taylor expand with respect to c, this becomes phi of x plus derivative to first order plus higher order stuff. So to lowest order in this gauge parameter, the change in phi from its original value is just d mu, d mu c, which is what I've written here. You can go through and do the same exact thing for the metric now, if you like, as well. So the metric g mu nu of x under a diffeomorphism f changes as a tensor transforms with derivatives up front. You need an inverse power of f to get this right. So beta f of x. So again, you can expand this, if you like, for infinitesimal xi, the same kind of infinitesimal xi. And what you'll find is that the change in g mu nu, there's now three terms from expanding the f here, from expanding here, and from expanding here. And what you get is a part that looks like this, which comes from expanding the first part, g mu nu. And then there's two additional terms, which come from expanding these two factors respectively. Okay, so this quantity, it's known as the Lie derivative. It just tells you the infinitesimal amount by which g mu nu, or any other tensor for that matter, transforms under an infinitesimal diffeomorphism. So now you can, if you like, convince yourself that these partial derivatives here, I want to turn them into covariant derivatives so I can make it look like this. The claim is that if I replace all these partial derivatives by covariant derivatives, it doesn't matter. So the claim is that if you expand out all the Christoffel symbols from these covariant derivatives, all the Christoffel symbols will cancel out, and you'll recover this. So I'm free to write like so. Now we know that the covariant derivative acting on a metric is always zero, so this is gone. And now I can use these g's to lower the indices on c, and I recover this expression. Okay, so this is in infinitesimal form, the gauge symmetry of our original full action, the redundancy that we have to deal with. Okay, but we aren't dealing with the full action. We've expanded the action to quadratic order in these fluctuations. So we have to understand what does the gauge symmetry look like to this order. So we have to take the gauge symmetry and also expand it to quadratic order in the fluctuations. So we write down what we know for the transformation. So we know that the transformation of the full metric, which I'll now call g tilde, is equal to the full d mu c nu d nu c mu, where these indices have been raised and lowered by the full metric, so I'll call tilde, and that this covariant derivative is with respect to the full metric. But now we want to expand this in powers of h, so we write d of g mu nu plus h mu nu, and then this we also have to expand in powers of h. So to lowest order here, there's going to be a term which has no h's whatsoever. So that's the term in which all these covariant derivatives are ordinary derivatives. And this c is the c which is lowered by the background metric. And then we'll have terms which are higher power in h, starting at order h to the 1 and possibly more. This is just some fixed background. It doesn't change. So this whole side becomes just the change in h mu nu. H mu nu is the dynamical field. So this, to lowest order in h, is our transformation law. It's the transformation to zeroth order in h. And what you can show, if you like, is that this transformation is an exact gauge symmetry of the quadratic part of the action. Anytime you have a Lagrangian and you have some parameter in which you're expanding it, if you take the lowest order part of that expansion and also take the corresponding lowest order part of the gauge transformation, that lowest order gauge transformation will be a symmetry of the lowest order part of the action. So this is a gauge symmetry of this quadratic action that we've written down. And if you're so inclined, you can show explicitly that it's a gauge symmetry. But you don't have to, because you know it must be by the way these expansions work. Yes.
But you haven't got the same order in both, right? It's to zeroth order, and there it's to second order.
That's right. It's not crucial that it's the same order. It's crucial that it's the lowest order. So the more general way to show this is as follows. So let's say I have any Lagrangian that's expanded in orders of some parameter, any parameter. And that order can start anywhere you like. So let's just say it starts at order n, and then I have n plus 1, ln plus 2, and so on. And let's say I have a gauge transformation of the fields. I'll just call the fields phi. And let's say that this gauge transformation is some f of phi, which can be expanded also in orders of the field, and it can start at any order. Mm-hmm. So let's say it starts at order m. So f of m plus f of m plus 1, and so on. If I know that this full thing is a gauge symmetry of the Lagrangian, it means that I know that the variation in the Lagrangian with respect to the full delta phi is equal to 0 up to total derivatives. Now expand this in powers of this expansion parameter, I'm going to have L sub n plus L sub n plus 1 and so on times f of m plus 1 and so on. And now this has to be 0, but it has to be 0 order by order in whatever parameter I've expanded. So in particular, the only term in this expression which has order m plus n is the first one. L sub n with fm has to be 0. I should have written d by phi here. Okay. And then you can, at higher order, you'll get additional relations. But no matter where the expansion starts, it's always a symmetry. Okay, so this is the diff invariance of the H, and then you can go through and do the same for the phi. And we find that to quadratic order, the phi symmetry, it looks the same, C mu of d mu phi, except that this d mu phi is acting on the background phi, because we've expanded everything in powers of the phi tilde. So these two transformations together are the gauge symmetry of this quadratic action. Leave that quadratic action up there. Okay, so the next step is to do like we did for electromagnetism and break up the field into its various irreducible spatial components. So the scalar field phi is already scalar. There's nothing we have to do for that. But the tensor field has to be broken up. So H mu nu has to be decomposed. And we decompose it into its time part, its mixed time-space part, and its space-space part. And we'll give names to these fields. So H00 we'll call capital phi. This is going to turn out to be the Newtonian potential. The vector part has to be broken up just like we broke up the vector of electromagnetism. We break it up into a transverse part, which we'll call V, and a longitudinal part, which we'll call B. So V, the derivative of V is 0. And we're going to stick a power of the scale factor of our background up front. This is just for convenience for the later formulas. We'll be algebraically nicer if we include this factor. Okay, so the expression up there didn't care about the it was for a completely general background. Now we're restricting to an FRW background. So we have in mind that the background satisfies the equations of motion for our FRW, which are the Friedman equation and the scalar field equation. And we're going to have to use this extensively to simplify the quadratic action. We haven't assumed anything about slow roll or anything else. So this is general cosmological perturbation theory that you can apply during inflation or after inflation, or in any situation in which you have an FRW-like symmetry. You can even apply it in cases like a domain wall spacetimes where it looks like a sideways FRW universe where you have some spatial direction which is preferred. Okay, the tensor part now is the more complicated expansion. So this we expand just the same sort of way that we expanded the polarization tensor for the CMB. We expand it into a part. So first of all, there's going to be a factor of a squared for algebraic convenience. We expand it into a part which is a transverse traceless spatial tensor, which we call gamma ij. So this is going to satisfy the property that it's transverse and traceless with respect to the Minkowski or the flat spatial metric. There's then a part which is a longitudinal vector, which looks like this, a vector field W, which is going to be transverse. Then there's a part which represents a longitudinal or a double derivative part, which is a scalar, which we'll call chi. And then what's going to turn out to be the most important part is the trace part of the spatial metric, which we call zeta. And it comes with a factor of 2, which is traditional. Okay, so it's this zeta which is going to turn out to be, at the end of the day, the only actual physical variable in the particular gauge that we choose. All this other stuff is going to be pure gauge and auxiliary stuff that we just integrate out. And this is going to be the only scalar left at the end of the day. And it's for this scalar that we're going to compute the inflationary power spectrum. So people talk about like the power spectrum for zeta, or using zeta gauge, or using or sometimes called co-moving gauge, which is the choice we're going to eventually make. But we're going to go as far as we can without making any gauge choice, to be completely general. Okay, so if you like, you can show that you can construct projection tensors that are analogous to the ones we wrote for ENM that tell you how to decompose in this particular way and tell you that this decomposition is unique. So any given tensor can always be decomposed in this way. The various components of the decomposition are always unique. And the other way, given any decomposition, there's only one way to sort of combine them into a tensor like this. Okay, so now, so I'm not going to show these projection tensors explicitly because we don't actually need that if you just believe that this decomposition is actually unique. Okay, so now we have all these various pieces, and what we can do is just brute force, take this, plug it into the quadratic action, expand everything out. That's the exercise that's on your in your homework. But before we do this, it pays to look at what the gauge symmetry is, because the goal you're aiming for is to get everything in terms of gauge invariant combinations. So let's start by looking at what the gauge symmetry looks like acting on these particular spatial variables. Okay, so the original theory has the diff symmetry, which is up on the top board there. The change in H is this part that's zeroth order in H, and the change in the scalar looks like the diffeomorphism of the scalar, but with the background present there. So what we do is to take this gauge parameter xi mu, and we decompose this in the same sort of spatial decomposition that we had before. So xi mu is going to have a time part, which we'll call epsilon naught. And it will have a spatial part, which also can be decomposed into a longitudinal and transverse part. So we'll call the transverse part epsilon vector, and the longitudinal part epsilon scalar. So epsilon vector is transverse. And now we simply take this gauge transformation law, and we plug this in for the gauge parameter, and we plug that in for the fields, and we equate the components on both sides that have the same transversality structure. Okay, so for example, let's do the simplest case, which is the scalar. So if I look at the scalar fluctuation, it looks like xi mu, d mu, phi, the background. The background depends only on time. It doesn't depend on space. So I only get a zero component here, d0 phi. Epsilon 0, we called epsilon 0, but there's a lower index here. So I have to lower the index at the expense of a minus sign. And then I can write this as phi dot. So this is now my transformation law for the fluctuation of the scalar field. You can do the same for all the other components. The first thing you can say immediately is that if I look at the tensor component, if I look at gamma ij, this must be gauge invariant, because there is no parameter that looks like a tensor for xi. And there's no way to contract things up to make something that transforms like a tensor, because of it has to be linear in the gauge parameter, and because of all the transversality properties, there's nothing I can write on the other side here. So you can immediately say that the tensor modes are gauge invariant. So these are the easiest modes to deal with, because you don't have to worry about the gauge symmetry at all. The vector modes do get a gauge transformation, which I'll write down. Here, scale factor again. H is the Hubble constant of the background, and you see that neither of these is gauge invariant. They both have gauge transformations, but the gauge transformations only depend on the transverse part of the gauge parameter. They don't depend at all on the scalar part of the gauge parameter, because they can't, because this side is transverse, this side also has transverse, so there can be nothing like a gradient of a scalar that appears. So the gauge symmetry always completely factorizes between the tensors, the vectors, and the scalars. the scalars transform only under the scalar parts of this symmetry, the vectors only under the vector parts, and the tensors under nothing because there is no tensor part of the gauge symmetry. And the quadratic action will also factor. There can be no cross terms between the tensors and the vectors, the tensors and the scalars, or the scalars and the vectors, which means that the system basically completely decouples into a tensor sector, a vector sector, and a scalar sector, each with its own independent gauge symmetries. So we can deal with them all separately. Okay, so there's a particular combination now of these vector fields, which is gauge invariant. So there are two vector fields with one gauge symmetry. So there's going to be one combination which ends up being gauge invariant, or actually physical. So that combination is, we'll call it G tilde, and it's this, A times omega dot I. So this is a your gauge invariant combination. And we expect to be able to write the action for the vector parts solely in terms of this gauge invariant combination. And you can check explicitly, if you like, that this is gauge invariant. If I do a gauge transformation on W, there's going to be a time derivative of epsilon, which cancels against the time derivative of V coming from this part of the transformation. And then the time derivatives hitting the A will cancel against this Hubble factor that appears here. So these gauge invariant combinations are traditionally called Bardeen variables. There's only one of them in the vector case, but we're going to find more of them in the scalar case. So we'll pick up tomorrow with the scalar part of the action. Any questions?
Okay. So the number of Bardeen variables in each sector, scalar tensor or vector, wouldn't change even if we chose a different gauge.
That's right, because they're gauge invariant. Independent. The variables themselves are independent of the choice of gauge. They're not unique choices, though. They're not, because you can always take linear combinations of one Bardeen variable with another one and get, so different people have different choices that they like, but they're always independent of gauge.
So they're numbers.
Yeah. Okay, see you all tomorrow.